Greetings, friends. We welcome you back to the Church is Changing podcast, a ministry of the United Methodist Church. And I'm Paul Nixon, here with my colleague Felicia Hopkins from Northwest Texas. Hello, Felicia.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I am doing well. And how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. It's a bright and sunny down here in the great state of Texas.
You are the last district superintendent standing for the Northwest Texas Conference of the United Methodist Church. And you're a busy one because the whole conference is your district at this point, basically. Is that the way it works?
That's true. I just answered the phone and I said, hello, you've reached the conference district super. Oops. This is Felicia. How can I help you?
Very good.
After disaffiliation, we had four districts. And after disaffiliation, we all became one.
So Northwest Texas had, I guess, one of the highest disaffiliation rates in the United Methodist Church. About 80% or more of your churches bailed out. So you're left with a district that is scattered all over the place. What has been required of you as a DS encouraging the folks that didn't want to leave, either because their churches stayed or they wanted to stay and their churches left? What's been required of you as a leader trying to shepherd all of this?
Well, it has been, for all intents and purposes, an absolutely wonderful leadership moment in time. It has been a time for us to really understand and see the miracles of God. But as a leader, I've had to have vision. As a leader, I had to stay ahead of the power curve. As a leader, we've had to hold and be pastoral as people have grieved the loss of the conference and their friends and their Sunday school classmates. As a leader, I've had to be still. And as a leader, I'm a retired Army chaplain, and I worked in a hospital for 12 years. And when I worked, I had, back in the day, two pagers and a cell phone. And I knew that whenever my phone went off, my boots were beside the bed, I'd put them on and go. And so I have reverted, if you will, back to that mindset. And it has been, I must tell you, it's been very hard, but wow, has it been very meaningful and hopeful for all the folks here.
Your conference leaders kind of scrambled last year when you saw that the number that were leaving and you saw some people that wanted to stay. And you created a new category. And refresh me on what it is. Was it Wesleyan Fellowship Groups? What were these groups called?
We created what we called Wesley Community Groups.
Community groups. There we go.
And what we figured, so I have an area over 50,000 square miles, if you can imagine. So I go from Abilene, Texas, all the way almost to the top of the panhandle, to Dalhart, then down to Midland. It's almost like a triangle. And then down east of Abilene. So we noticed that there were pockets. For example, Amarillo is in the panhandle. It's the largest city in the panhandle. And they have 225,000 people. And there was not one United Methodist Church left standing. And so we scrambled as quick as we could because there were people who wanted to be United Methodists, who were committed to our Wesleyan theology. And within a matter of a week, we had those folks meeting in a nursing home, and we went from the nursing home to meeting in another church. And right now, they're a thriving congregation of 100 plus in Amarillo, because we just could not understand having a city of that size without a dedicated United Methodist Church. So we've done that in five or six different areas all throughout the conference.
And you said, you know, it's you referred to it sort of being ready to put your boots on at any moment. It's kind of your mentality. But you said it's also been an encouraging time. What have you found so encouraging in this time?
Oh, so number one is the laity has always been, theoretically, the foundation of the United Methodist Church. And I have seen laity step up and lead their churches and provide support and care and love and food like never before. I mean, I have seen them hold, if you will, the church together for all intents and purposes. And I've seen them build churches you know, opened their homes to have house churches that grew to larger churches. So it's just amazing. That has been amazing because we have learned to become a professional church where we feel like we pay pastors to do the work of ministry. And now, even, you know, post-COVID, we got people out on the street asking people to come to church because we know they really believe in it. So that's been one thing that has really opened my heart. And I tell people all the time, everyone here in Northwest Texas voted to be here. And so we don't have to beg anybody to do anything to help. People are willing to give whatever they have to maintain the legacy of United Methodism. So it is a positive vibe. People call you and they say, can we do this? And they don't even know what a fresh expression is, but they're trying it out in cattle country. And so it's just been wonderful to see the people of God doing ministry outside the walls of the church on days other than Sunday.
So these folks that chose to stay with the United Methodist Church, even with some pain as they were watching their, perhaps the congregation where they were baptized 70 years ago, leaving the denomination, they chose to stay. What are some characteristics that they all had in common that you've just noticed?
If we start on the negative side, they're all grieving. Like you said, people were baptized in the United Methodist Church. These are people whose Sunday school class members have been together 20, 30, 40 years. These are people who went to high school in smaller communities together. They know each other. They went to each other's kids' baptisms. So they're grieving. And there's been a broken trust here for us in that, you know, how you think you know somebody and then you think, well, maybe I don't know them. And that's healing. We have intentionally talked about grief, talked about the five stages. We've intentionally said it's okay to grieve. Everybody grieves differently. But while you're grieving, you are not alone. And so out of that, it's kind of like a desert has come an oasis where people have been probably more transparent and authentic with each other, where people have had conversations about people in their family who may be queer in orientation that never told anybody. And so they really have become more of a faith-filled community. And it's funny because they're all over the place, right? So my office is 5.5 hours from my furthest church, but I feel like I know them now better than I knew them before. So, you know, all of them, the majority of them have been strong, and the majority of them have been strengthened, in their Wesleyan theology, right? Because this is all about, if you're old like me, open doors, open hearts, open minds. And so people have really had to think theologically about what they believe. So their roots, their faith roots have gone deeper.
So during this season, these folks they're processing and as they move beyond the grief, where do you see these folks going? What kind of adventure are they up for in some of these cases?
They are up for whatever comes. I have a small community out in Haskell, and they just couldn't, three little communities, Haskell, Mundy, and Throckmorton, and they couldn't figure out what to do, and they didn't want to always drive 30, 40 miles in to a larger church. So they are meeting in a party center the second and fourth Sunday, and they've said, it's okay to meet twice a month, and they go to the larger church for communion. But they take a Sunday and do service. So they're breaking the mold. They're saying, we really are going to be ecclesia, right? We're not just going to be the building. We're going to be ecclesia, the body of Christ. And so relationships have been so strengthened, and creativity. I think I mentioned it before. You know, everybody talks about fresh expressions. Well, I got people in rural areas who don't know really what that means, but they're doing it. They're praying for people at the pizza joint that's open on Sunday because that's the best place to eat. I was at a pizza parlor last Sunday, and one of the pastors, they go there every Sunday. And one of the pastors got up and talked to a lady behind her. Really, what she was trying to do was get her cheese stick because she didn't order any cheese sticks. And she asked the lady if she could have one, and the lady said yes. And then she got up and she sang to the lady. And she asked her, oh, what song would you like me to sing? And she sang to her. And on the way out the door, there were tears coming out of these folks' eyes. And the man said, are you guys here every Sunday? And she said, yeah, just about. And we'd love for you to eat with us. You know, this is rural Texas people who have been emboldened by the Spirit of God to share and to reach out. A lot of that fear that we have with the big E word just has gone away.
How have you kept such a positive and cheerful spirit? And I presume you have your moments because you've grieved also to see so many colleagues leave. But every time I seem to run across you, you seem to exude possibilities and hopefulness. How have you nurtured that during such a crazy season?
Yes, I've had my moments. And I tell people I would never want to go into 43 churches again and hear them in great numbers leave the United Methodist Church. I love the United Methodist Church. It saved me at a time where I didn't know where else to go. And I will tell you, I'm still crazy enough to believe that nothing is impossible for God. So I always tell people I'm a conduit. So I want the Spirit to flow through me to them. And I'll tell you what I learned, even after 28, 29 years of ministry, is that I needed God more to do what God had called for me to do. And I just ask him every day, God, just show me the glory. Tell me why I'm doing this. I think I shared with you that in my ministry of almost 30 years, I think I've had three Esther moments. And I believe this to be one. Really, if I perish, let me perish. But I'd be dadgum if I was going to go down without a fight to keep the United Methodist Church alive in Northwest Texas. So I believe God's working miracles today. You just have to look at our conference. I tell everybody we're the best little conference in Texas. And that just kind of gives me joy. It gives me joy that people are really preaching the word. It gives me joy when I have a pastor who stands up and says at her church conference, oh, I'm so excited because we have just doubled in size. And everybody claps. Well, for her, that means she got 30 members now. And they're out, right? They're out. I tell all my churches in my little towns, if you have 10% of the population, you're a mega church. So like in places like Pampa, they got 15,000. Hey, you're on your way to being a mega church. So their joy fills my joy, right? When the church functions the way that I believe God had intended, it brings me joy. When we're not so caught up in programs and caught up in budgets, but when our eye is really on the thing that's on God's heart, it brings me joy.
You are a pastor in your 60s, and as am I, so we can share that in common. And you seem to me to still be in learning mode. You're not coasting at all toward, you know, whatever finish line there is in terms of active season of ministry, but you seem to be learning a lot. Have you learned anything new in the last couple of years from all of, or at least had maybe things you knew that were just underlined again for you?
I've learned a lot new in the last 3 years, I can tell you. You know how you look back at your career and you think, oh, I wish I could take that sermon back, or I shouldn't have said that. And I think the one thing that I've learned, and it started in COVID, right, was the church really is about relationship. And it's not about a relationship on Sunday morning, because Sunday morning is the most segregated hour still in the United States. But it's about reaching out one-on-one. When I came out of COVID, I told all of my pastors that one of their top five things I needed for them to do was I needed for them to evangelize someone every year. I would have never said that before. I said, you can't stand in the pulpit and tell other people to go out there. And you, who have you talked to? Who have you evangelized? I learned that. Next, I've learned, I got all this energy, right? And I'm moving, 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 moving. But I've had to learn how to be present and be still. And that has been one of the hardest things for me. A friend of mine did a study of the book of Jonah. And chapter one is be present. Chapter two is be still. Chapter three is tell the truth. And chapter four is then to let go of the end results. And I think having gone through this disaffiliation, that is the biggest thing I've learned. That, you know, the people of Nineveh didn't necessarily all get saved and sing hallelujah and glory. They did what Jonah thought they were going to do. That wasn't up to him. His job was to do what God had called him to do. So I've learned that. I've learned that the church is not dead. It is yet alive. And I think on the sad side is that my eyes have really been opened to a lot of hurt that people have felt from the church, outside of the church. And so that's kind of heartbreaking for me, but I think it gives me fodder to sit down with those people and try to show them the love of Christ.
One of the things that I've been aware of with Methodism in the part of the world where you lead is that as the area has become more and more persons of color, specifically Hispanic Americans, the churches haven't really kept up with that shift. And the churches still are largely Anglo, even though many of these communities are Anglo minority now, they're actually Hispanic majority. You are a person of color and not Hispanic, but a Black woman in West Texas, surrounded by lots of white folks and Latina. What has it been like for you ministering as a person of color in an area where Black presence may not be as common as it is in some other places? I mean, how have you had to prove yourself again? I mean, overt racism is alive and well these days in places.
Yeah, I could tell you a couple of stories about me pulling into Redneck Pete's gas station 3 years ago.
Is that the name of the gas station?
Yeah, and a pastor had to come and called him, and he came. He said, stay right there. I'll pump your gas, pay for my gas. And I skedaddled on. I grew up in Buffalo, New York. I was a part of the very first desegregation program there. I grew up poor. People always told us we had to work harder than anybody else. Then I went in the military, and that was ingrained in me, right? But I've been, I guess for 12 years, I was the only African-American elder, male or female, in this conference. And I did work harder just so that I could be seen. And thanks be to God, God did wonderful things in all the places I was appointed. He used me, I will tell you, to help some other people see. Like people say, they don't see my color. No, no, I need you to see my color. I need you to see me and who I am as I present myself in the world. But I learned a long time ago, and it's always been. When we grew up, we had poor white people, poor Hispanic people, everybody in the projects, right? You eat at somebody's house because you hungry. So I've never had the luxury of not liking or talking to somebody because of the color of their skin or their sexuality, or never had the luxury, the privilege of doing that. And I've always been taught to go do my job the best that I can. And if I can't do it the best, then don't do it. I've made mistakes. Yes, I've seen racism in the church. I've seen racism in the appointment system. I've seen racism in administration. I will say, I feel it's getting some better, but it's hard to get better when people think that the Hispanics and the African Americans and the minorities have to fix it. For me, it's a majority problem and a recognition. You know, I just always pray and hope that it'll be better for my boys, right? My mother prayed it'd be better for me. My grandmother prayed it'd be better for her. My great-grandmother, who was in slavery, prayed it'd be better for her. And seemingly it is. I mean, my great-grandmother would never, ever think that I could become a district superintendent over all these churches in a predominantly white United Methodist church.
She would get quite a kick out of that, in fact, I would imagine.
Well, she'd be drinking her beer and really enjoying it. I can't say the words that she would be saying. You know, isn't that everywhere you go? And that's one thing the military taught me, I must tell you. I went in the military at 23, and I grew up, as I told you, in poverty. I went to the military at 23. And nobody in the military cares what color you are. They care, can you do your job? Because I might need you to do your job to save my life. And I was an MP, and, you know, we go out all over the roads and traverse things. So I always learned, I really care about how well you're going to do your job. And I want the best person. So I assume that most good leaders want the best person.
You know, a lot of people talk about the Army toughening them up for whatever in life. Did it toughen up you for dealing with the local church?
It did. And when I got out, I had to soften it. I was an MP. I used to direct a prison. I knew how to tell you to get where you needed to be and don't move till I get back. I won't say I was hardcore, but I will say I was very efficient. And I learned a lot about administration and leadership in the military. But when I came out, I had to soften that approach as I learned that most people just really don't want you telling them what to do. And that it's teamwork, right? I treat everything like a pie. I love to bake. Everything's a pie. And if you eat that whole pie, you're going to be sick, right? And the more slices you eat, so just eat your piece. Clean up your little slot, and then I'll clean up mine, and you clean up yours, and you clean, and then it'll be done. But we're so busy keeping the pie to ourselves and not sharing. So
you have worked over the last 2 years hard to retain a United Methodist presence in Northwest Texas, and you've worked with beautiful people that have just surprised you to no end. But what's at stake with trying to retain a United Methodist presence of ministry in this 50,000 square mile land? But why is that important to you?
What's at stake for me is the gospel of Christ. Methodists, we have a great gift to offer people. The reason I'm Methodist is because of grace, right? I'm one of those people, I didn't grow up, but my life was changed when I began to understand the grace of God that God gave to me, when I understood that grace of justification or sanctification was for me, and that I didn't have to be perfect, and that God loved me before I was saved. God loved me saved. God loved me good, bad, and different. We have a great message and brand that I don't think we're really sharing with others. And if nothing else, how we treat those who may have hurt us in disaffiliation will go a long way in our communities showing the power of the grace of God. So for me, it's imperative. I know people who've grown up in churches and have never heard about prevenient grace. They've never heard the grace of God in such a way that they could present themselves authentically at the cross. So we got a great message. I think we need to double down into it. I just think that as a United Methodist person, that I can be a light in dark places and in some of these small communities, just as I am.
Your conference is now going to be merging with two other Texas conferences. Will that happen at the end of this year? What's the timetable on that?
Well, our bishop now will retire officially 1 September after jurisdictional conference. And jurisdictional conference has to approve the unification of the new conference.
Got it.
And once that's done, we are scheduled to vote in a approval in a unification conference September the 28th. So the goal would be that by 1 January 2025, that the people in North Texas Conference, Central Texas Conference, and Northwest Texas Conference would all be one new unified conference. And it's been a year of work and learning. And we believe in Northwest Texas, it is the best thing for us. We'll become the far west district of the whatever conference. They had a, Bishop Sines had a convocation day, a covenant day for pastors in September. I think it was September. And all these pastors came together from all three conferences and were in this room worshiping together. Now, that's not something our pastors have been privy to. I mean, we had smaller numbers, but to be in this place where 350 pastors and three bishops are actually worshiping, it can change you in a way you never thought. So we're hopeful in the new conference. We're hopeful that we are yet alive. We are hopeful that we're going to be able to lean into the new mission, that we're going to be able to lean into the five distinctions that we have with the vision. And some of that we're already doing. So we're very hopeful.
Well, I'm hopeful as well for you. I have history personally in North Texas Conference. That's where my ministry journey started. And I have been a fan of that conference and have been amazed at how well they, partly because of Episcopal leadership, but how well they have hung together through this, through these years of crisis. And there are some powerful, dynamic churches and leaders there. It'll be great to be connected with that. That'll be a, that'll be good, good for Northwest Texas, I would think. Well, I want to just say thank you for your work on the on this sort of frontier space. You never, I never really thought of West Texas, Northwest Texas, as Methodist frontier space because we've had a strong presence there over the years. But it sort of has become that again for us in some places, that it's sort of a wide open place to rediscover what does God want to happen here.
Yeah, and I, you know, you see that in churches every week. I told you about the church where she said they doubled. I had another church last week that had 11 people and a family of four joined. And they were like, yes, thank you, Jesus. So we're out in the frontier, right? We're canoeing our way. We are figuring out how to augment what we had, really, so that we can be yet alive, still be a beacon in some of the communities. I'm old school, so I still believe that every church door that's open is there for a reason, that God has a purpose for them. And we really have to dig down to get into that. So I don't mind being a frontier girl, getting me a wagon. And, you know, I don't want to wear them old dresses and boots, but I can be a frontier girl, Paul.
It's been a blast to chat with you today, and I am hopeful for this land that you have served and that you have loved so well in the last several years. And we appreciate what you're sharing, especially about the courage and the spunkiness of these laity all over the conference area that are hanging in there and discovering one another and creating new places of faith community.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you for thinking of me. Blessings.
You bet. Friends, this is Felicia Hopkins. She is the district superintendent, the conference superintendent of the Northwest Texas Conference of the United Methodist Church, which will continue to exist till the end of this year, most likely merging with North and Central Texas. I'm Paul Nixon, and the Church is Changing podcast is a ministry of the United Methodist Church.
Church is Changing podcast is a production of Discipleship Ministries, an agency of the United Methodist Church. Music is by Sanjay Singh. Visit all our podcasts at podcast.umcdiscipleship.org.